suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrant. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrant. Caffeine, not coffee. Taking Vibrant may result in increased productivity and decreased dread in setting alarms. Unexpected enjoyment of the graveyard shift has been associated with Vibrant. Vibrant may be a better budget option than drinking coffee. It may also decrease the urge to doze off, skip work, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12.
Welcome to Going Shamanic. My name is Jen Ingrassio, and my medicine name is Snowhawk. And I'm your host today with producer of Page Media, Marielle Smith, managing things in the background. Today's show is all around healing addiction using shamanic tools and shamanic wisdom and knowledge and technologies that get to the root cause of what the addiction is about. Today we're welcoming Michelle Fire Riverheart, who healed an addiction using shamanic technologies. But before we chat with her and welcome her, I wanted to introduce our topic with some words from a book that I read recently that I found really helped me to understand addiction, something that I've also struggled with in my life and healed. Dr. Gabor Maté is an MD that has had extensive experience working with people addicted to various things, I should say, in the downtown East Side neighborhood in Vancouver. He's also a recovering addict, and he wrote a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, which really, I would say, is a must-read for anyone seeking to understand what addiction is and what might be required to heal it. He goes through the causes of addiction, but also what happens physiologically and what role society has to play in both the rise of addictions, but also in helping people to heal from addictions. In our culture, no one is really untouched by addiction. Everyone knows someone or knows of someone who has been struggling with addictions, in different forms, whether pretty devastating addictions or ones that, you know, people would say are maybe not as serious, quote unquote. So I'd like to just start out by reading a short passage from the book. Addictions always originate in pain, whether felt openly or hidden in the subconscious. They're emotional anesthetics. Heroin and cocaine, both powerful physical painkillers, also ease psychological discomfort. Infant animals separated from their mothers can be soothed readily by low doses of narcotics, just as if it were an actual physical pain that they were enduring. The pain pathways in humans are no different. The very same brain centers that interpret and feel physical pain also become activated during the experience of emotional rejection. On brain scans, they light up in response to social ostracism, just as they would when triggered by physical harmful stimuli. When people speak of feeling hurt or having emotional pain, they're not being abstract or poetic, but scientifically quite precise. The hard drug addict's life has been marked by a surfeit of pain. No wonder she desperately craves relief. Quote, in moments I go from complete misery and vulnerability to total invulnerability, says Judy, a 36-year-old heroin and cocaine addict who is now trying to kick her two-decade habit. I have a lot of issues. A lot of the reason why I use is to get rid of those thoughts and emotions and cover them up. The question is never why the addiction, but why the pain. So it goes on now to say to talk a lot about those people that he works in the downtown East Side, and a lot of them having had a lot of traumatic experiences when they were younger, a lot of abuse. And people interpret their experiences in life in different ways. And so for the purpose of this show, we're looking at addictions and, you know, what they are and why people turn to them. And so to help us do this, we've invited Michelle Fire Riverheart, a colleague of mine and a friend, to come and speak about her own experiences. Michelle is a certified shamanic coach, and she herself has overcome addictions through the use of shamanic techniques and the help of shamanic coaches. So welcome, Michelle.
Hi.
Hello.
Again.
Hello. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So, Michelle, how would you define addiction?
Well, addiction is actually in the brain. Some substances create a physical dependency, but actually even that physical dependency isn't necessarily addictive. It's a misunderstanding in our society that, you know, substance in and of itself is addictive. Because I used to always make this joke that I could actually be addicted to corn. Because, you know, that was the truth, and it still is sometimes the truth of my life. If I allow my neurochemistry to get so low that I am not a choice anymore in being able to say yes or no to something that's harmful to me, that substance that I choose to use can become an addiction. It's always a choice when you have control of where your neurochemistry is at.
Mm-hmm. So at what point, because some people would say that addiction is not a choice. It's pretty common in our culture to blame whatever we're doing on other things. So at what point would you say that it can become, at what point does the addiction sort of start to rule someone, if it does? Like, what is the line there?
Yeah, well, it's different for everybody. But that is true, and it's. But I'll take it always back to neurochemistry, and I'll give you an example. When I was in the height of my worst addiction, which was cocaine, I used to wake up in the morning in complete and utter paralytical fear. And until I got sober, I assumed that that was part of my addiction. When I was sober, what I realized was that that experience of fear in the morning was actually super, super low neurochemistry. I don't know when the point comes for each and every one of us that use some substance or thing to boost our neurochemistry, when that comes where you no longer have the control over it. But what I do know is that unless you surrender at that point, you are lost. I was one of the lucky addicts, I would say, in that I was a functioning addict most of my life. I wasn't the addict that was on the street. I never allowed it to get that far. When I knew it was going to become that point, that is when I absolutely, finally, totally surrendered, left my life, packed up everything, closed businesses, left my child, left my mate, and made it out to work with my shamanic coach one-on-one intensively for numerous years. But until that point, I had pretty much lost control over what I could say yes or no to, but it was also predicated daily on what stress I was under. Mm-hmm. So my teacher used to say, you know, addicts, when we're at that point that you're referring to where we have, where the addiction is the number one need to be met every day, it still, for me, was a battle of, okay, first stress, no, I'm fine, I'm not going to use. Second stress, no, I'm fine. When you get to stress number 5 in a day, typically you cave to whatever the addiction you can afford at that time of that day is, whether it's overeating, whether it's doing a joint, whether it's doing a line, whatever it is that you can afford and what you like. Mm-hmm. Does that answer it?
Yeah, it does. You know, for me, it was a similar kind of thing. I didn't realize that until I started my healing journey with the addiction to food that I didn't have good strategies for managing stress.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, later learning that, you know, some people don't have very high dopamine levels in their bodies already, so those people tend to be, they tend to be the ones that will turn more to addictions to sort of, to feel better, to cope with stress, with everyday living. So for me, personally, it was a lot about, okay, you know, I have stress in my life. This thing is stressing me out. How can I develop strategies to cope with the stress without sort of, I would do this thing where I kind of distanced myself from it or separated out from it instead of trying to work with what was happening in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what kinds of shamanic practices you engaged in and what kinds of tools really helped you to learn how to work with the stress in ways that didn't take you down that addictive sort of cycle and patterning.
Well, for me, I'm one of those people that keeps going even when the sign says stop. So I never even knew what a strategy was until after I had surrendered and given up my life and everything else and moved to work with my shamanic teacher for numerous years. Up until that point, I didn't even understand what strategies were. My strategy, even though it was unconscious, was, okay, deal with the stress. You can do it. You can do it. Pop some codeine during the day. You can do it. You can do it. Okay, no, you're not doing it. Okay, it's Friday. Use some cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Until I was taught about strategies, I didn't use them at all. So I was already out of mainstream life by the time I came to strategies. Subsequently, so I can only talk about strategies and use of strategies from a sobriety perspective, because when I was in my addiction, I never used them.
Mm-hmm.
Now I use them to stay sober. And I have to be totally vigilant at all times. So I use, I have an underlying problem, which is depression. I have low neurochemistry. That's what set the whole ball of wax off. So I use sun lamps. I use exercise. I use what we call in shamanism feeding our hungers. So making sure that every single day I do something that nourishes my heart and my spirit. Mm. I am vigilant. Some of my strategies are really ruthless. I have to have no addicts in my life. Mm-hmm. I will not have a friend that is an addict. I will not have a mate that is an addict. That's a really difficult path to walk because most people have addiction of some sort. I have to, if I have, like I have, you know, you even have to go to the granularity of clients.
Mm.
If you actually have a severe addictive personality, you have to choose that your number one reason to be met every day throughout every aspect of your life is your sobriety if you want to actually maintain it. And so that has resulted that 4 years sober tomorrow,
Yay.
Yay. I pretty much don't have many friends because most people are addicts. But that's okay because going back down the other road is not worthwhile to me anymore.
So describe that, what you're saying there about that most people are addicts. Now, you said that it has to do with neurochemistry. I mean, I would define addiction as anything that we do outside of ourselves to cope with something. It's instead of using our inner resources to cope with something, using something from outside of us to help us to cope, to feel better, to live through the moment. So when you say that, what kinds of addictions are you including in your definition of addiction?
Oh, okay. So for me, I have to be addiction specific. So anything that is for me would for me be an addiction. So if someone's a shopaholic, I don't care, because I'm not a shopaholic, never will be. I have too much attachment to money. So I look for people with substance addictions that can't be in my life, because that's my issue primarily. That does actually include food, and I've had to lose the only what I considered sober friend recently because of that addiction, because I went back into food addiction.
Mm.
When I first went out on my own and I started eating. And that friend had to go because she supported my addiction rather than stood firm in, she supported me having the addiction rather than supporting me and not having the addiction, because she also had a food substance addiction.
Mm.
So I would bump into her in the store and she'd be like, oh, I'm getting chocolate. What are you getting, right? No. What I need in a friend is someone that says, oh, great, you're getting healthy choices. And I can say, I really want chocolate. And that friend will say, yeah, but Michelle, do you really want to eat that chocolate? Or can you say no and choose something different? Those are the friends I absolutely have to have in my life if I want to stay sober. Because, yeah, today it might be chocolate, but if I let that chocolate get out of control,
mm-hmm.
right? Tomorrow, because I've gained 50 pounds, I'm even more depressed, and now I'm like, screw it, I'm just going to have a glass of wine, right? And then that glass of wine could eventually lead me to drinking with others, and oh my goodness, there's a line on the bar. Okay, done, we're back to square one.
Mm.
That is why I'm so ruthless with who I allow in my life, on an intimate level. I mean, you have to engage with people, period. But you can choose where you socialize, and that's the line that I draw, is where I socialize.
Mm. Now, I know Marielle has a question here. Marielle, do you want to step in here with your question about neurochemistry?
Well, actually, I had another question pop into my mind a moment ago, too. It's fascinating, Michelle, to hear what you're saying. There's two questions that I have. One, how did you get to the choice of getting sober? And two, I also read Gabor Mate's book, and he talks about self-regulation and how the amino acid depletion in our brain, the physiology, also has a part to play. When there's imbalance, it doesn't help in the choice making. So for somebody who has a low or a depleted amino acid in their brain, how do they get back to that ability to self-regulate? Because it's just not there physiology-wise.
Right. Honestly, I don't know how addicts ever get to that point without totally taking themselves out of life. But that's because of my personal experience. I have an extremely addictive personality. I reading Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghost, finally gave me some empathy for myself, some compassion. I had never had that before.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no way, even today, I can hang on to sobriety and live in a city. I can't do it. I cannot handle stress at that level. I've had to accept that. Because I have low neurochemistry as a baseline, I'm always propping it up, always propping it up. How I got to the point of surrendering, right? That was your first question?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had been walking a shamanism. Is actually, addiction brought me to shamanism. Mm. I had been doing years of work, you know, self-help books, everything I could find, and nothing gave me enough stability to get sober. And I saw an ad in a magazine in Ottawa. I lived in Ottawa at that time. Just an introduction. It was Healing the Broken Circle. It was a different pathway than I'm on right now. But it was a meld of shamanism and gestalt therapy. And it was a young one-year program that you had, I think it was five long weekends and then 1 week long of ceremony on the land.
Mm.
I was so desperate and I had no money at the time. I literally took my rent and put it down.
Mm.
That's where I started with shamanism. That worked. That program actually got me sober for 13 months, but my underlying problem was this neurochemical imbalance that had depression. I had constant depression. And so although I had been sober 13 months, I was so depressed. I was feeling suicidal. I finally went to the doctor and asked for antidepressants, and I am not an allopathic medicine girl. So this tells you how desperate I was. She knew all about my addictions, my ex-addictions and everything, and she put me on a drug that, after the very first one, it felt like coming down off cocaine. And I remember I was in a shamanic circle at that very day, my very first pill, and I said, I feel like I'm coming down off cocaine. But I happened to be a drama queen back in those days. And so everyone was like, yeah, yeah, Michelle, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. We know you don't take pills very often, right? Anyway, within 2 weeks, I used that. It did feel to me like coming down off cocaine. Within 2 weeks, I was back on cocaine. And I was so angry and so disappointed in myself and still looking at someone to blame. I wasn't yet in the self-responsibility piece. That I went and I went to the doctor and she referred me to a doctor that specialized in the interaction between street drugs and pharmaceuticals. And he looked at me and he went, well, of course. And I said, I beg your pardon? He said, of course you went back to cocaine. That drug, you need 15 months sober off cocaine before you are put on that drug. So I then bounced around. I think I had 8 months sober here and there within the next few years, and that was 2004. And it took me till 2009 before I actually 100% surrendered. And how that came about was I was finally all on my own. My child had left home. And now I had always lived for my child. That is what had kept me going my whole life. I had been suicidal most of my life. But when I had that beautiful, beautiful child, she kept me going. I wanted to be there for her. I wanted to be the best I could be for her. But now she was gone. I had to live for myself. And I went into probably the worst addiction I had ever been in, with cocaine and alcohol, which I had never used before. And I was so desperate. And I was in shamanism at this point quite deeply, and I was a pipe carrier. And so I started praying with my pipe and sleeping with my pipe. And I did this for a week. Don't mess with the pipe, folks, because it's going to give you what you need. So every day I was in a situation where I was not spending more than I had, but exactly what I had. I could still make my bills, but I was spending every dollar on addiction that I had extra. And this, I was getting paid daily. So I'm now banking on what I'm going to get at the end of the month. And every single night I slept with my pipe, the next day, my clients canceled for that day. I'm at the end of the month. I'm now down a week's worth of income. I can't pay my rent. What happens next? My roommate asked me to move out in a month. Well, what I knew at that point in my life was that I would become a coke whore. And this was a line that was my bottom line. I would not cross this line. And so I surrendered. And I talked to my shamanic coach in Ottawa, and she said, well, what about, I said, I'm missing a piece. My best friend, my blood warrior sister, she said to me, and if it had come from anyone else except her, I probably wouldn't have heard her. And she said, Michelle, you need to go into recovery. And I said, what's the point? I have been through healing the broken circle, it didn't work. I've been through a shamanic sweat lodge ceremony for healing my addiction, that didn't work. I have tried everything, it didn't work. What's the point? And she said, you need a time out from life. And she was right. And so I started researching, and I found a really wonderful program out here in BC, but it was $30,000 for 6 months. Didn't have that. Because I was not in alignment with modalities that say that you have a disease and that you should you know, surrender all your problems and ask someone else to solve them. I did have the self-responsibility piece at that point, that it was my problem. I had to work the program, but taking self-responsibility. And so it was suggested to me to ask the head poobah of our shamanic circle at that time, who happened to live out here in BC, if I could come and work with her 101 on the land, because she had been working with me since 2004 on my addiction. And so she had a partner, and I called her, and she said, uh-huh. She said, okay, well, I got to ask my partner. Give me 3 hours, and I'll call you back. Said, okay. She called me back in 10 minutes, and she said, okay, we say yes. We need you for 3 months minimum, and you will be here in 3 weeks. And I went, but, and she goes, I know you can do it. Bye. So I packed up and recycled all my belongings. I closed up two businesses. I kissed my daughter goodbye, and I broke up with my mate, and I was on the plane and landed here in BC 3 weeks later.
Wow.
That's how I ended up surrendering. So I guess how I got to surrender was ultimately the pipe.
Huh. And your line. You said everybody has a line, other people say that they hit rock bottom.
Yeah, that was my rock bottom.
Yeah.
Was that because I knew that is where I would go, because I was going, I had no money, right? So I knew I wasn't going to be able to have a place in a month, and I had nowhere to go. I knew I'd be on the street, and I knew I was in such addiction that was my primary need to be met. And what would I do to get it? Anything.
Mm.
So I surrendered. Yeah.
Wow.
So, Michelle, could you describe a little bit about what the pipe is? Because there are people that might not know some of these terms that you're using.
Okay, so when I speak of the pipe, it's not a crack pipe, it's not a hash pipe. This is a sacred pipe. It is a Native American pipe. There's a whole story that went with how the pipe was brought to the people by White Buffalo Woman. So if you would like to research the pipe and White Buffalo Woman, there are your tags to go Google that. But we use our pipes for ceremony, but also for personal ceremony, to connect with our highest good, with our spirit, to connect with other spirits as well. It's a tool like anything else, but it's a tool with a long lineage in this reality. And so, therefore, that energy that the pipe is has a very strong energy that is heard throughout the energetics of the universe.
And so what role did your pipe play in your addiction healing, like throughout? I mean, you talked a little bit about how it got you to healing, to the point where you surrendered. What role did it play throughout your healing? How did you use it?
Well, as an addict, I could not connect with my heart, right? My heart was totally shut down. Mm. The pipe has helped me open up that heart space. So I used the pipe whenever I wanted to run. I used the pipe when I was doing healing work and I couldn't pull it, you know. We have ceremonies, and within those ceremonies, we're looking for pieces of our puzzle that we want to heal and release. And sometimes we have blockages. So when I come to a block in a ceremony, I'll use my pipe, because for me, it gets me out of my head. It gets me out of that stuck point and allows me to sort of have an additional tool where I can sort of be away from myself, but get the answers I need for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I just, when I use the pipe, I feel connected to all my lifetimes. I feel connected to all my sacred ancestors that are Native American, even though I have no Native American blood in this lifetime. it feels like the most natural thing in the world and the most sacred for me.
So what attracted you to shamanism? Because it sounds like you're, I don't know if you've always been this spiritual or had a spiritual connection since you were young, but what is it about shamanism and not going into, you know, regular rehab, if it had been affordable, that attracted you there?
Well, yes, I was always very spiritual. I was raised Roman Catholic. I was the leader of the Christian life movement in my convent growing up.
Wow.
But, yes, but what happened to me was hypocrisy. I grew up in South Africa, and in Roman Catholic faith there at that time, you got confirmed at 13 years old, and confirmation meant that you were accepting all the rules and the laws of the Catholic Church as an adult and saying this was going to be your faith. And long story short, I had a problem with that, was sent to the priest, and he basically told me just to suck it up and lie. Mm-hmm. It was in that moment that the Catholic faith lost me. And then I was just kind of agnostic for many, many years. But when I came to this country at age 16, 17, Native American spirituality just fascinated me. I didn't have any in-depth access to it or anything, but it just fascinated me. And I had this feeling and connection that it felt comforting. It resonated with me. And so when I saw the shamanic program, Healing the Broken Circle, I just jumped at it. And as soon as I started the program, it felt like, oh, I found my people. Mm. That's all I can say. I found them.
Yeah, and, you know, I just want to also emphasize that piece of the role of community and healing addictions, because, you know, addicts tend to be kind of isolated by nature.
Mm-hmm.
We isolate ourselves unless we are, you know, among people that have the same sort of addictions.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of isolation and shame and despair there can be. So what would you say, Michelle, what is the role of community members and family members and society at large in helping people to heal from addiction?
I'd say
we can't do the work for people.
But what it is, it's like everything. I mean, I don't think without the community, without the people that were around me, not necessarily full-time, even here and there throughout my healing process of my addiction, because I lived and worked with my shamanic teacher for 3.5 years on her land, and that was my focus for 3.5 years, was just healing as much as I could. Mm-hmm. But you need that mirror of reflection from others to show you how much you've changed. So, for instance, I used to be a very angry person, very, very angry person. And so people that met me at the beginning of my healing journey and then didn't see me for, let's say, a year or something, and then came back, and I had definitely healed and softened, and they would say, I was so terrified of you.
You mean like
it
me?
It was scary. You growled in the morning. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I growled in the morning. They're like, yeah, like we were all scared of you. We'd come into the kitchen and you would like growl if we made noise. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Well, Michelle, I was one of those people, I have to say.
Yeah.
I'd come through my weekends and I would, you know, I remember the first time I met you and you were very guarded. And this was many, many years ago. I think 2009 was the first time I met you.
Yeah.
And, and you had joined the program I was in for coaching. So you and I did a lot of healing work together too. But at the beginning I thought, oh my God, you know, this woman, like I don't know what to make of her, but like, I don't want to get on her bad side. She'll kill me. Right. What I didn't know was, just how big your heart was and how, just to see you just throughout the years blossom into who you are at your spirit level of this, you know, artistic, creative, joyful person that really comes through in your artwork. So, I just want to say, wow, like, what a transformation. I mean, we laugh about this now, but at the time, everything was felt quite serious, really. So how, like, so you talked about, like, not surrounding yourself by people that are addicted, but, you know, we know that people came onto the land that were struggling with addictions and healing all sorts of other things. So why was that different than maybe interactions you've had with other people that were not doing healing work in the same way?
Because first of all, primarily, there was a rule that it was a safe space and there was no addictions allowed on the land. Even for me working there, there was no one rule that if I went into addiction, I could, you know, I was over and out. But the rule was if I went into addiction, I had to leave the land until I was sober and I would come back, you know. Mm-hmm. That never happened. But the people that came to the land and were working on addictions, no one that I know of ever broke that rule. And we were all there on our healing journeys. It's a very different energy when someone comes to a place with an addiction working on their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're open, you're honest, you're authentic, and that vulnerability, as frightening as it is, just opens up because you're in a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually helped me, and I hope other addicts, that we were there at the same time, because you always call in the people you need, and if you're aware and awake and looking for your teachers, you always can learn something from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so without those people coming, I would have not learned as much as I did about myself or healed as much as I did. I mean, it wasn't until I met another person that had the exact same I want to put this in layman's terms, not shamanic terms. She presented the exact same way as I did to the world in the way she engaged.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I met her and she scared the crap out of me that I realized why other people were afraid of me sometimes.
Mm.
Because I finally could see from an outside perspective the mirror that I put out to other people, because here it was being reflected back to me. So, you know, just as addicts when in addiction flock together, addicts when they're working on their stuff can heal far more together than alone. Like, and I would never choose a teacher to help me heal that had never had an addiction, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's the other thing too, is that there's a feeling of there's a baseline of non-judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people are telling their experiences or I'm not going to say stories because that's something we really stay away from in shamanism. But people are speaking their healing pieces or pieces that they're working with healing. And, you know, it was the first time in this community, in these shamanic communities, I should say, that I learned how to really listen to another person.
Mm-hmm.
Without judgment, just really hearing them. And there was a piece, especially when listening to people that were healing from addictions, where I was like, you know, this is something that is not talked about in society at large. Addicts are sort of, it feels like addicts can sometimes be the scapegoat for all these things society doesn't want to really look at. But, you know, there's this other piece too, where it's like, you know, there's a lot of power in just speaking what is without any flowery bits or trying to soften the impact of it. And, you know,
not to kind of glorify things, because that's not really what it is either. It's just seeing things as they are and then finding ways, using the shamanic tools and the techniques to and technologies that have been around since ancient times, to sometimes it's a matter of, you know, there's a piece of that person's spirit that needs to come back to them.
Mm-hmm.
So would you talk a little bit more about the specific tools that you used, but also, you know, tools or practices that you could recommend to people that are maybe listening and living with addictions or, you know, struggling with these kinds of things in their life?
Right. The number one thing is to know whether you're in or out of balance. That's the starting point for it all. I was not even aware of where my balance point in my body was. And anytime your balance point comes up your chakra line or down, doesn't matter, depression is equally out of balance as being totally revved, you are at a higher risk of caving to your addiction. Mm-hmm. So what my teacher had me do for the first 3 months, anytime I was awake, was to watch where that point was. And anytime I was out of balance, so where your balance point is in your body, where your energy should sit when you're in balance, is about 2 inches below your navel.
Mm-hmm.
We call it the one point. There's lots of different terms for where that is, but it's where you feel where your energy is the most in balance. So anytime that rose or went lower, I had to stop, and I carried a little book with me and a pen and analyze 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, whatever I had decided was going to be my baseline of how bad it was, write it down. Why had it happened? What was going on with my internal dialogue? I mean, that was pretty much all I had at that time, because I was just working in the bush all the time. I had no interactions with anyone except my teacher pretty much at the beginning. So what was going on for me at that time? Why had my energy spiked?
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to, a karmic cord cutting. So it's cutting that energy away. So for instance, if I even think about doing a line, I can feel it in my body right now. That's why we don't tell stories in shamanism, because that memory is real in your body. It's not just a memory. Your body reacts to that memory. So I would take the energy from the top of my head, pull it down out my navel, and then cut it away. And then I would put my hands over my heart and do forgiveness work. Forgiveness work for myself. We always think of forgiveness work as forgiving others, but actually the most important forgiveness work we can ever do in this lifetime is for ourselves, for things that we have done to ourselves, haven't done to ourselves. So this process went on daily for every single time. And then what it did was, first of all, make me very aware of where my energy was. But it also had the added effect of that I was, every time that happened, healing a little piece of myself.
Mm.
Healing another little piece of myself.
And reclaiming.
Healing another little piece of myself, right? So I used that. Physical labor for addicts. Number one,
mm-hmm.
Get onto the land. Do something physical daily. It grounds you whether you want it to or not.
It also spikes your neurochemistry, or I shouldn't say spike it, but it actually enhances it. The the happy hormones sort of come out. So that's kind of a secret about physical exercise, is it actually does clear out your energy system. So really important for addicts. What about nature? What's the role of being out in nature, would you say, from a shamanic perspective?
Well, we're connected to nature, right? It brings you back into balance. Nature is naturally in balance unless humans have messed with it. When you're out in nature, you right away become more grounded. if you're looking for signs, there are medicine signs everywhere that will help give you healing opportunities. And I don't know, that connection with nature, it takes me back to a time when there was, you know, I feel purer out there. And that's not the correct terminology, but natural. Mm-hmm. It takes me back to my naturalness, and it takes me away from my internal dialogue. For me, being in nature, I just am happy. I mean, that's all there is to it. And I have to get out into nature as often as possible.
I find it also quiet. It quiets all the clutter and all the voices in my head so that I can actually really just hear my high self when it's talking to me. It's the same thing with ceremony. You know, when it's just me out in nature doing a ceremony, there are no distractions. It's just there. You're there, and you have to deal with yourself. You can't, you know, go to an addictive pattern. You can't, you know, go watch TV or, you know, do all of these and millions of other things that we do to get away from ourselves. So it's like really a process of pointing myself back inside of myself to find the answers. Can you talk a little bit, too, Michelle, about a medicine sign? Like, maybe do you have an example of a medicine sign that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
I was just talking about medicine signs with someone this week, and I have very specific signs that are huge, you know, that you, like, okay, so I was, for us on the shamanic pathway, the owl is the symbol for the sacred dream of life, which is, you know, creating what you want in this lifetime. And I was at a certain point in my journey, in my healing journey, where I was starting to think about that and choosing options. And I don't even remember anymore what was going on then, except for that particular fact. And I was walking through the forest. It happens to be called the Yogi Forest. Very cool. I love living on Gabriela Island. And there's nothing here. There's no predators here. Our biggest animal is a deer, okay? And as I'm walking through this forest, I see this humongous animal. Like, I mean, about 3 feet, like, out of the periphery of my eye. And so my brain computes, right? It's like, it's not a deer. What the heck is it? And so I focused, and lo and behold, it was a great horned owl. And it had to be like 30 feet away from me. So here I am at this moment in my journey looking at whatever it was about my sacred journey that I was going to manifest now in sobriety. And here is the sacred owl, right? The symbol of my journey saying, and so to me, now you can interpret it any way you want because symbology is the interpretation of the seer, right? No one else can interpret your symbology for you. But for me, that meant, yes, I was doing the right thing.
Mm.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like when, you know, we each have our own spirit animals that work with us that you can, you know, anybody out there can do, you know, request a drum journey or, you know, sometimes some of mine came to me in my dream time too, where these helper spirits come and they, you know, they share their medicine with you. And so when I'm out in nature on ceremony and there's one of those animals comes into my space,
mm-hmm.
I pay attention.
Yep.
They usually have something interesting and very poignant to share with me about whatever it is I'm out on ceremony working on, whether it's a ceremony to help me to move past fear or, you know, whether I'm out there trying to find answers to a particular question I have, whatever it is, really.
Absolutely. I mean, ceremony has given me, there have been ceremonies that have scared the heck out of me so badly, but I have made it through that. Those ceremonies are the ones that help me get through everything else in life. You know, if anything was big, I'd go, yeah, but I did that, 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 that.
Exactly.
If I did that, I can do anything.
They show you the strength of your spirit, really. It's hard, kind of hard. Shamanism is one of these hard things to kind of talk about because it's so experiential and it's so personal. Every single person is going to have a different experience. I mean, I could have been out there with you looking at that owl and got something completely different.
Completely different. Like, are you afraid of frogs?
No.
No. Okay. I happen to have been terrified of frogs when I went to Healing Broken Circle. And so I'm out doing an overnight ceremony. We don't give details of ceremonies in shamanism because it diminishes it for you if you then go and do the ceremony. But anyway, I'm doing a very, very, my most scary, very, very long overnight evening ceremony. And everyone got what they needed that night. And what I got was this damn frog. Michelle, terrified of frogs. It was probably a tiny little frog. Anyway, the joke of the whole thing was what that frog did for me in that ceremony that evening was, number one, help me to pray. It was exactly at the moment where I was supposed to be praying for my addiction, and I decided to go to sleep, but the frog showed up. Yeah, there's nothing happening there from spirit. And then what the frog also taught me was I had to ask for help to get rid of the darn thing. Because I was so terrified of the frog, I couldn't do anything with it. I ended up chucking it in my can, which was for my ceremonial cigarettes, my prayer cigarettes. And then, of course, now the frog's in the can with the friggin' cigarette butts and the nicotine and everything. Now I start praying for the frog that it's not going to die because of my fear. Yeah. Okay. So this is shamanism. It's wacky, it's deep, it gets to the heart of the matter, and it gives you experiences that you will never forget and that you can use as a foundation to pull yourself through any other scary moments in your life.
It really draws on your inner strength and your inner resources.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I was terrified of the dark before shamanism.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I would just add, too, is there's something to be said for being able to look at the totality of yourself, the shadow parts, but also all the light aspects and all the gifts, without ego, you know, without putting a lot of self-importance on things that shamanism gives us access to that also helps on our journey, I find. So I keep going back to this. Well, how can we make this useful for people listening? And, you know, some people are not going to uproot their lives as you had the courage to do, you know, for many reasons, might not be able to leave or be willing to leave and come and live with their teacher or live on the land, as you talk about. So what would you say to people out there that are looking for a way to heal their addiction and are drawn to shamanism?
Well, number one, find a shamanic teacher. But the first and foremost thing is you actually have to be at that point where you are willing to surrender, to let go of everything and make the number one need to be met, your sobriety. Mm-hmm. If you're not at that point, that's just where you're at. But don't do the dance of pretending, because it just creates more and more heartache and more disappointment. I think every addict I've ever met has been really great at beating themselves up. And it just keeps the cycle going. Do one thing a day, a small thing a day. Even if you're still in addiction, do one small thing a day that you can be proud of. And don't talk about it to other people. Don't give that power away. Keep it for yourself. Mm-hmm. One small thing a day and build on it. If you're actually ready to really give it your all and quit, find a supportive community. Get out of any environment that has addiction in it. So if you're with a partner or in a living environment that has addicts, you need to remove yourself from it. Or honestly, your success rate is really, really handicapped by that. And yeah, sometimes that means leaving a mate, and I know that firsthand. And it's not hard. It's not easy, rather. It's really hard, but it's essential.
In your opinion, is it possible to completely heal addictive patterns?
I don't know yet. I'm hopeful. What I know for myself at 4 years is that I'm still using food now. But the difference is that now that I've had 4 years of sobriety, with my neurochemistry being more balanced, I am more at choice. Mm-hmm. What I don't know is that if I'll ever be able to get my neurochemistry up to the point where I don't have to be as vigilant as I am and constantly work on it. So I work on staying happy with sun lamps, with what I eat, with what I don't eat, with who I surround myself with what I do every day, with exercise, with what I watch, what I listen to, what I read. We're all different. But what you have to do is figure out who you are and then work with it. Hmm. I do believe that there is a point. And you know what, as I'm thinking about it, I don't know if I can say yes for myself 100% yet, because I'm still dancing with food. Until I don't dance with food, I can't say that I'm 100% sober, really, really, because I'm very, very rigid. So for me, it's all or nothing. But what I have seen in people that have been in shamanism a long time, they have healed addictions to the point where I've seen alcoholics that can now drink once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I've seen people that, you know, have had severe addictions and have totally healed them and don't use other things anymore. Mm. I won't say there's a lot of them because it's a really, really hard pathway to walk, but it is attainable.
Yeah, and there's a piece, too, of believing that you're more than just that addicted personality. There's more to you as a person than someone that's addicted to something. So in
Absolutely.
A way, it's like reaching for those other parts of you that don't have to do with that thing without negating that thing or, you know, shunning that thing, because that's not useful either. But yeah, it's like a complete acceptance of all the pieces of who you are, but also bringing them all in so that they're all talking and they're all sort of working together.
Absolutely. And not using the crutch of, I am an addict.
That's right.
And also acknowledging, like, something that's not talked about is the skills and abilities you acquire being an addict. Think about that. All of you that are listening that are addicts, you have amazing skills and potentials that you can wield. Addicts, what do we know? We know how to get what we want, and we know how to do it really well and really quickly. You can use that skill in other areas,
mm-hmm.
right? We are very focused. We're very driven. All these are really positive tools that we can use when we're sober as well. So it's just cross-training those skills and abilities that we acquired to get our addictions. We can cross-train them in the positive and not just see addiction as a terrible thing. Addiction is actually a way that you survive. It's actually a brilliant way, because without that addiction, you might have been dead. But there's a time when you need to lay it down and get happy again.
Why do you think your spirit chose addiction, and what did it teach you? What was the biggest piece?
Addiction taught me that I can do anything, actually. It taught me that if I assert my will and my dedication, I can do anything. Now, when I was in addiction, I didn't really believe that. But in sobriety, I think about everything that I went through and everything that I've learned, and I know that I am at choice, and that those skills and abilities and that addiction helped me be who I am today. And I regret some of the things I did in addiction, but I don't regret having gone through it.
Mm. So what would you say to listeners that are maybe living with addicts or having to interact with addicts? What would you say to those people?
Oy.
Yeah, in terms of support, because I think they're all, you know, most people are trying to figure out how to support these folks, but they don't always choose the best strategies for supporting these folks.
Mm-hmm. Number one, no bullshit.
Mm.
Addicts have supreme bullshit detectors, and we really, really detest that kind of thing. So no nonsense when it comes to speaking the truth. Most addicts I've ever met were very intelligent people, actually. I remember one guy that was absolutely stunned that I was smart. And it's true of most addicts. They are actually usually out-of-the-box people that are intelligent. So treat them as such. Do not support their addiction. Like, you know, when they're drunk and they call you, say, "I love you." When you're sober, please call me and I will be here for you. Do not support them when they're in their addiction. Support them when they're in their sobriety, even if it's only for a few hours.
It's tricky with some addictions more than others. Like mine was food. And so, you know, I come from a really big Portuguese family. Food is like at the center of everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, whenever they're socializing, food is there. And it's kind of the center of the culture. And so I remember, you know, none of my family, you know, knew that I was healing a food addiction at the time. But I remember being at my mom's house, and one of my trigger foods was sugar, refined sugars. And so I was drinking coffee, but I didn't take sugar anymore. And I was really specific with my mom that not to put sugar in my coffee. And she heard me, but she ignored my request and she put the sugar in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the cup over to the sink and I basically dumped it down the drain.
Right.
But I was already at a point in my healing where I had enough personal power and enough strength inside of me. I've built up enough of that through the healing work to be able to do that. And it didn't require me saying anything to my mom. But, you know, when I looked at my culture, it was like the whole culture is sort of built around enabling certain addictions, you know.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you can just talk a little bit more about that, because some people think that some addictions are harmless, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
But for me, my personal view, and I know there's lots of views, is that, you know, if whether it's just you that's being harmed via the addiction or whether your addiction is impacting other people, it's still causing harm to someone.
Yeah, well, I always go for myself to within my own circle. So my father's French, so I came from a very similar culture to yours, and when I couldn't drink, oh my God, the world had ended. So, I mean, they actually got quite angry that it was just stupid. And why didn't I just say no once I'd had a couple, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was not going to be any understanding. So what I did with it was just, I used humor, actually. We call it, the Hayoka or controlled folly. But humor is really great at changing the dynamic of a situation. So either you can blow it out of proportion and go, "Oh, my God, I know, the world is ending. Michelle can't drink. What are we going to do?" Or I would go up, because my dad was the prime catalyst for this, because he was an alcoholic, and I would just, he hated being, he was not a loving sort of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I totally ignored that. And I would go over to him and I would squish him and love him and say, "Yes, I can't drink and I love you anyway."
Mm-hmm.
Because what I knew was that food and drink and all of that for him was a expression of love. Mm-hmm. And he, in the face of not being able to share that with me, was at a loss at how else to express his love to me.
Mm-hmm. I think that in those cultures too, it is very much an expression of love in the way that, that's the way that they know how to express it. Whether it's, you know, helpful or not is another conversation, but at the heart of it, it comes from a positive intent.
Yeah. And then I always think of the 7 generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter how bad it looks, if I stand strongly in my circle, if I get so much flack because of it, I don't care because there are little eyes watching me.
Mm-hmm.
And you never know what impact your being strong in that moment, no matter how hard it is going to impact the next generations to come.
And people sense the energy, too. Like, I remember I didn't tell anybody in my family what I was doing. So, I mean, they still don't know. They might know after they listen to this joke. But, I would go back home every once in a while because I now live in Calgary. So I would travel to Vancouver every once in a while, and people would always comment that my energy was different. They wouldn't say those words, but, wow, you're really different. Or, you know, when I lost, 30 pounds, people were just kind of like, what happened to you, you know? But it was more than just the way I looked. They were responding to, I didn't react to things the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't interact with them the same way. And it was a really direct way of seeing that all the work that we do, or that I did in that situation, is actually impacting my family. There was more of an ease in the communication than there ever had been because I wasn't looking for approval from them
mm-hmm.
like I was in the past. I wasn't, devastated if, some aunt or grandma made a comment about my weight or, just things that people say, and they're not meaning to be hurtful, but, we take them through our filters and we do what we do with them, right?
Right.
So I could see, and even today, wow, the communication is so much different. There's so much more heart space there than there was before.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's, for me, I'm still working on opening my heart and being vulnerable. It's just my challenge.
Mm.
But being able to speak my truth, not carrying all this baggage around and all this self-hatred and being so angry at everything, I don't know how actually my physical body survived it.
Hmm.
When I look at it, from this point in my life, I'm like, wow, you were a strong girl because you survived all that physical addiction, all that anger, all of that hurt, and you came through it. Because nowadays, I couldn't even imagine, doing it. And it was only 4 years ago.
I was saying the other night we had a women's a sisterhood night where women came together and told power stories and and I was telling a story from my addiction healing time, and one of the things that I said, which is that our spirits are incredibly strong and fierce when it comes to our healing. They're benevolent. They want the best for us, our high selves. And it just, that whole process really just struck me about like, wow, this is how people can survive abuse and trauma and all these other crazy things that happen to us here because our spirits are so incredibly strong on a level. And so what strikes me too is that in listening to you is that you were able to grab that piece of yourself that was fierce and strong, that part of your spirit, to help you to pull through.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, and honestly, though, I mean, my belief system has helped because I believe in reincarnation. Mm-hmm. I just got to get my crap together because otherwise I've got to do it all over again. I really don't want to. So That's actually, as humorous as it is, it was quite the motivating factor, because when I was younger, I didn't have that belief system, and I was very suicidal. Once I got that belief system, that actually was part of all my motivations of, you got to keep trying, you got to keep trying, you know?
And in shamanism, you do come across those past lifetimes, too. And some of them, actually, I had memories of when I was younger, but I didn't realize they were past lives, so I was very confused about what was happening. And when I started doing the drum journeys, and even sometimes in the sweat lodge, these lives would come back. It was kind of a relief. You know, I was like, oh, okay, these are just parts of my former selves that are, and former lifetimes that are healing, and that's why I'm here, to heal those things. And a lot of that was all interconnected with the addiction.
Yeah, you know, it's exactly that. Like in one of the sweat lodges, we call them the Shinamiya, they're the keepers of the books of a life, and they communicated with me that this was my 9th lifetime of addiction, and I had never succeeded in overcoming addiction. And for us, 9 as well is movement and energy. So that all wove together to tell me, like, wow, if I get it together, if I really do it this time, I'm healing not only this lifetime, but many others, and my soul will not have to deal with this, hopefully, again, you know?
And you also pave a way for your future ancestors to heal those things, too.
Yeah, and just, you know, I remember my child, when I was in my worst addiction, my child was 14 to 16, and I've always been very ruthless and open, and one of her friends called me, she'd had an overdose, and she called me to the hospital to take care of her, and I was talking to her, and she said, you know that your daughter has told me that the reason she's not an addict is because of you.
Mm.
And that gave me hope, you know, that at least because I'd been honest and I'd tried so hard, that my kid had seen the challenge and seen the danger, and it helped her on her journey, right?
Mm.
So it's not just for ourselves. You know, if you can't do it for yourself, do it for others. It's always been a way that I've helped myself, in a very cunning, back-ended way, you know, get sober and stay sober. If I can help others and be of service in my sobriety, that as well helps me to stay sober.
Mm. Michelle, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking.
We've come to the end of our show. Michelle also has her own business and website, www.galagohealing.webs.com. We'll post that on the Page Media site. Thank you for everybody that's been out there listening, and be well and be happy.
Hope.
Okay. Hope.
Suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrant. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrant. Caffeine, not coffee. Taking Vibrant may result in increased productivity and decreased dread in setting alarms. Unexpected enjoyment of the graveyard shift has been associated with Vibrant. Vibrant may be a better budget option than drinking coffee. It may also decrease the urge to doze off, skip work, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12. Do you suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrant. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrant. Caffeine. Not coffee. Taking Vibrant may result in increased productivity and decreased dread in setting alarms. Unexpected enjoyment of the graveyard shift has been associated with Vibrant. Vibrant may be a better budget option than drinking coffee. It may also decrease the urge to doze off, skip work, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12.